Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is John Dennehy. John is the founder of My First Bitcoin, or Mi Primer Bitcoin. It's a Bitcoin education nonprofit based in El Salvador. The project has taught over 20,000 students, including the first students anywhere in the world to ever receive a Bitcoin diploma program in a public school system. It has open sourced all of its educational materials and has ambitious plans to teach millions of students in El Salvador and beyond. I met John on my recent trip to El Salvador, and I'm excited about having him on the podcast to tell us about Bitcoin education, how they do it, what lessons they've learned, and how he recommends you go about it. So, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's good to see you again.
Likewise. So, let's first get started with you and your backstory. What got you into the Bitcoin rabbit hole?
Bitcoin's such a fascinating thing because we all have our own stories that are all like worlds in themselves. I first heard of Bitcoin in 2013 when there was a Cyprus bail-in with the banks there. I read an article about it and there was a line in it that said Bitcoin users unaffected or something, and Bitcoin price has gone up because of this. And I was like, wait, what price has gone up? So I looked into it and immediately, you know, was drawn to the idea. So a little bit of background before that, I had lived in Ecuador maybe 6 or 7 years before that, and a new government took over and they didn't recognize the visa of the previous government, and I ended up getting deported because of it. And I had a bank account in Ecuador and they in that process, they seized my assets, right? They like froze my bank account. I had personal experience that really helped me see the importance of the separation of money and state before I ever heard of Bitcoin. So then when I did hear Bitcoin, that it was this money that government couldn't censor, that couldn't control, that the individual could control it, then like it immediately clicked for me as, yes, this is something that I want to participate in, something that I want to succeed, something that I think could create a world more aligned with how I would like to see it. So I got in pretty fast and pretty deep in 2013. And then I kind of drifted, you know, still a fan of Bitcoin, right? Still like a huge advocate of it, but not super involved with it until more recently, just like 2 years ago with El Salvador.
Okay, so what got you interested in El Salvador then?
Yeah, so I've been interested in Latin America. I find Latin America to be a really fascinating part of the world, in large part because I admire the social movements here. I admire that people stand up for themselves here in a way that, you know, I'm from the U.S. and in a way that I don't necessarily see in the U.S. So I've been attracted to Latin America. I've lived mostly in Ecuador, but a couple of other countries in Latin America in my adult life. And you know, Bitcoin is also another thing that Latin America and Bitcoin are both things that I'm very attracted to. So when I heard that, you know, the announcement at the Miami conference in 2021, I was in shock. You know, like I thought that a country might adopt Bitcoin one day, but I didn't think it was going to happen then. So it was a surprise to me, but it was a very pleasant surprise. You know, again, this was on the back of the pandemic. So I was in New York for that. It was as clear as ever to me that the world was broken, that the world was on a path that was unsustainable. And in these long walks that I took in an abandoned world, right, like a world gone mad, I thought a lot about how we could get on the right path. And for me, the answer was Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin was going to play an important role in getting us on the right path. So that was a pre-existing thought. And then when I heard about El Salvador, there were some thoughts in my head already about how education, specifically in the Global South, would be really important, but a specific type of education, a type of education that was independent, impartial, and, you know, community-based. And it just seemed like El Salvador could be a good fit to, one, try that out, and two, if it failed, which I thought that it might, you know, before I go in there, like, that might not work out, but it's surely going to be a place where there's a lot of people throwing a lot of things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And you know, so I moved to El Salvador before the law went into effect, soon after the announcement, because it just seemed for me like a lot of different things had lined up. And I wanted to, like, I believe that, you know, there's a quote that I like, that the best way to predict the future is to create it. And I think El Salvador gives us that opportunity, right? El Salvador is a place where we could experiment and see what works. And I was really drawn to that.
Yeah, no, I can understand the appeal myself, if I may say so. I think there's definitely something interesting going on there. And the fact that they're getting into Bitcoin, I think, is just one, you know, it's what draws us as Bitcoiners there. But I think the country itself overall is going through something pretty astonishing. And you notice this over the last couple of years in terms of the change that has been going on there. So you decided to move to El Salvador. How does Mi Primer Bitcoin, my first Bitcoin, come about?
Yeah, so I... You know, I had worked through the idea a little bit in my head before going down. I had lived in Ecuador earlier in 2021, and I tried something similar, which didn't work out. You know, but to give someone a little bit of Bitcoin to go into their community and teach others about it, and as part of the class, like, give a little bit away so people could actually use it. And so I had the idea in my head. I had like a mission statement worked out, website, just like very, very rough outline. But when I went to El Salvador, the first place that I went to was El Zante, so Bitcoin Beach. You know, that's a really important place in the history of Bitcoin in El Salvador. That was an example that I think gave confidence to people that, okay, let's, maybe we could do this on a bigger scale. It worked in this one place, in this one town. So I went there to try to get a sense of thing. And then I went to San Salvador, which is where I've been ever since. I only spent a week in El Zante. And every Salvadorian I met, I asked them about Bitcoin and I asked them like what they thought about it. And if they showed any interest, if they would be interested in participating in educating others about Bitcoin, like educating their peers about. So it was literally just every single person that I spoke to, I just brought up Bitcoin. And what was interesting was in San Salvador, this is a different case in El Zante, but in San Salvador then, this is before the law went into effect, people had heard of Bitcoin because the announcement had been made already, but the Bitcoin adoption was very nearly zero in San Salvador at the time. Like, people didn't know very much about it. There was curiosity for sure. But so the first days, weeks, months of the project was a very eclectic group of Salvadorians. You know, it was somebody who was my Uber driver, somebody who I met through an Airbnb host, somebody who, like, it was a very diverse group of people. The common denominator was just that they were interested in Bitcoin and enthusiastic about educating others about that. But they came from a pretty wide variety, like a very diverse background.
Yeah. And so when did you begin with making Mi Primer Bitcoin?
So our first class in El Salvador was in September 2021, which is the same that the Bitcoin law went into effect. And, you know, in those early days, so the very first class that we had, we didn't have a space, we didn't have any resources. So the teacher of that class, his name is Victor, his sister is a yoga instructor. And she was able to lend us the space that she used as a yoga studio between sessions. There was like a gap there between classes there. So we used that space. We brought like fold-up chairs in. And one person came. So, you know, we grew a lot from there. But, you know, in the beginning, we were just getting our foot in, trying to figure out the best way to teach it, but also the best way to recruit students, the best way to do everything, right? Like, again, we came, the people in the early days came from a diverse background. And I've worked as a teacher before, but it was a totally new venture, right? So there was and continues to be a very steep learning curve. But yeah, humble beginnings.
Yeah. And so then how did this thing pick up?
Yeah, so we then in 2021, that was still the bull market. And, you know, as much as I wish that this wasn't true, there's a strong correlation between people's interest in Bitcoin and the trend of Bitcoin's price. There was a lot of interest. There wasn't a ton of knowledge. The knowledge base among Salvadorians here in San Salvador was not very high, but the interest was very high. So we were able to get more students. And the very original model that we had was that teachers were paid. So we gave a bonus in sats to the students so they could actually use Bitcoin in the class. But the teacher salary, this is all paid in Bitcoin. The teacher salary was dependent on them finding a place to teach and students to teach as well. So they were kind of like an all-in-one. So people started out just teaching their neighbors, their coworkers, their friends. And that picked up fairly quickly. So, you know, now the numbers seem really small, but at the time they seemed really big. So we had 5 students that first month in September, October. We had 80 students by November, then we had like 250 students, which at the time seemed like a lot, you know, for a project that had just gotten started. Then in 2022, you know, we continued to expand. We topped out in 2022 at 1,400 students in a single month. And we also added so in the beginning, it was just the intro class, right? So the whole project is focused on getting Salvadorians off of zero. We're not trying to teach Bitcoiners more advanced Bitcoin knowledge. We're trying to teach people who know little or nothing about Bitcoin and encourage them to take their first steps. So the very first class that we had, the only thing that we had in 2021 was an intro class, just a very basic introduction to Bitcoin. And in 2022, we started to add some more diverse educational offerings. Importantly, we added the Bitcoin Diploma, which is a 10-week program, which you know, it's financial literacy. The first four weeks are financial literacy, right? It's just about what is money, why is money, what is the history of it, how did we get here, and then we get into Bitcoin once that foundation is established, and that has been very successful. The Bitcoin Diploma has been very successful. We piloted it in one school. And there was just a lot of demand. Again, there was a lot of curiosity. There is a lot of curiosity here. So there was a desire for it. We now teach the Bitcoin Diploma in a variety of different places and schools around the country, out of mayor's offices, out of community centers, out of our own house. But all of it is by request, right? Like, we've actually never approached a school. We've never approached an institution and asked, like, hey, can we come here and teach about Bitcoin? And they've actually approached us. So yeah, there's that demand there. So the Bitcoin Diploma was really important for our growth. You know, things like Adopting Bitcoin, which is an annual conference here, that has been really important as well, because, you know, as Bitcoiners come here, then we get to meet them. There's a certain momentum to things, both with Bitcoiners that know about the program and then could support it, maybe by donating or contributing in a variety of different ways. Or the more students we have, the more they tell their friends, like, hey, if you want to learn about Bitcoin, here's a resource for you. So it's kind of gotten its own momentum now. But it's aided by the fact that we've increased the offerings. We also have occasionally we do have more advanced classes, you know, about hardware wallets or privacy, security, just some more advanced topics. That's not the focus. That's kind of an add-on. And sometimes internal, to make sure that our own teachers and the people that work for us, to try to better educate them. And then if it's successful, then maybe we offer it to the public afterwards. So yeah, just increasing what we offer has been really helpful. It's been really helpful to grow, just forming these partnerships with different people, like the Bitcoin Office with Max and Stacy has been really, really helpful in making introductions, to work with a variety of different people. And then, you know, I really believe that the success of Mi Primer Bitcoin and the growth of Mi Primer Bitcoin is multifaceted. And you know, I want to shout out all these great teachers and great people that work on the project. But I also think that it's an idea whose time has come, right? It's like right time, right place.
Yeah. What do you cover? So basically, first of all, what are the age groups that you cover? How old do you have to be to get into this?
So when we teach in public schools, then it's a narrow age range, right? It's like a group of students who are studying together, usually in their last year or two before they would graduate what I would call high school. 15 to 19, you know, depending on the specific group, maybe 16 to 17 is the average age, you could say there. But when we teach it outside of there, then it's open enrollment. And when we have open enrollment, then there's a wide range. So we've had a student go through the diploma as old as, I think, 81 years old. And this was actually somebody, this is a cool story. He lived in a very rural community, and it took him 2 hours on buses each way to get to the class. And he was like always early, always stayed late. So that's one end of the spectrum. And the other end, I think we've had students as young as 11 or 12. So it's quite diverse there.
Yeah. And so you think like 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, they're old enough to understand this material?
I think they are at the edge, right? So I think there might be some individuals who are 11 and 12 who could understand it. But as you get to 12, 13, then I think most 12 and 13-year-olds could. Like an 11-year-old, I think maybe a special 11-year-old can. Might be a little bit too advanced if you go younger than that. It's actually quite, you know, even though I'm talking about relatively young people, 11, 12, 13, 14, it's quite advanced, right? It is very suitable for adults as well. And in fact, adults sometimes find it more difficult because there's something of an unlearn in there, right? Like, whereas younger minds tend to be a bit more elastic with concepts that Bitcoin brings up. There's actually, I see a lot of pros with that younger demographic.
Interesting. So what are the, what is the material that you guys teach? Can you give us like an overview of what the content is?
I have a Bitcoin diploma with me right here. So I'll just open it up to the table of contents. So yeah, the first three classes are just a background, right? So it's what is the monetary system? What is the history and the evolution of money? What are the effects of fiat money and centralization of money? So that's just to create the foundation. And all of this, we try as much as possible to just present the information, right, as independent and impartial. And then the students decide, right? But it's important that we think it's important that they have that foundation to begin with. And then the rest of the courses, once we get into Bitcoin, once we get class four, which is the intro to Bitcoin, then class five is like how to move your Bitcoin and how to custody your Bitcoin. And like each class becomes a bit thematic then after that, you know, and there's a class that's just about miners and what Bitcoin mining is. And in fact, something that we want to do for that, we teach this in the city of Berlin here in El Salvador, which there's some Bitcoin mining nearby. So we're trying to incorporate that into the class at that specific location so they could actually go and see the miners in a lot of the classes. So when we talk about how to move Bitcoin, how to buy Bitcoin, how to custody Bitcoin, then we use different Bitcoin wallets so they could actually use it. There's a Salvadorian company here, K1, which makes a Bitcoin ATM, which is just, you could only buy Bitcoin with change. It's a very small machine. It's pretty simple, but it's very effective as an educational tool. I mean, it's effective to buy some sats too, but we try to make the education as interactive as possible whenever we can. And then we talk about like the scarcity of Bitcoin and the price of Bitcoin. And then we end it all with Bitcoin today and looking forward. And this is a little bit specific. So this talks about more recent things, right? So like Taro and SegWit and Taproot and all those things, but also specific to El Salvador, because this is contextual, right? Like everybody comes at Bitcoin from a different angle, and here in El Salvador, it's a little bit different than it would be in other places because it is legal tender. So we try to emphasize to students how they could integrate Bitcoin into their life and into planning for their future. And one of the things that we have on our roadmap is to try to create visible pathways to economic alternatives. You know, just having jobs boards, like there's somebody that we work with that is trying to, so he works in the call center industry, which is quite significant here in El Salvador. It's same time zone as the US and Canada, fairly significant English speaking population here, people that are capable to work for call centers based in North America for North American companies. So that's an existing industry here. And what one of the things that we're looking at, just to give an example, is to try to get Bitcoin companies to base their call centers in San Salvador and El Salvador, and to source the employees as graduates from the Bitcoin diploma. So students are able to see like, okay, this means something, right? Like this isn't just, I'm just learning about this thing and then I'm going to forget about it. Like this is actually something that could positively impact my future.
And so the material, I mean, a lot of people complain about how hard it is to get into Bitcoin, how hard self-custody is, how complicated owning your private keys is. But you're telling me here that, you know, high school kids in El Salvador can figure this out?
Yes. Yes.
A lot of Twitter thought leaders are going to be embarrassed to find out about this, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Bitcoin is what I have found based on personal experience with thousands of students is people almost always overestimate how difficult it is to start using Bitcoin. So that's one of the things that we try to do. So when we have meetups, so we have a monthly meetup in San Salvador, and we try to make it a desirable environment for Salvadorians to come to who are not yet Bitcoiners, right? I mean, plenty of Bitcoiners come, plenty of foreigners come, but we're always encouraged to try to get Salvadorians who are new to the space, and we'll give them a little bit of Bitcoin, and we'll negotiate a discount if you pay with Bitcoin at that establishment. So, you know, they buy a drink or an appetizer, whatever they're getting, and they pay with Bitcoin, and they've never used it before, right? And it so often is an aha moment for them, because like they had the idea in their head that Bitcoin was for other people. Bitcoin was for people who are very tech savvy. Bitcoin was for people who, Bitcoin wasn't for them. It was for somebody who was better versed in the topic, somebody that understood the philosophy, that understood the technology better than they were. And that's important, right? I'm not saying that you could learn everything in a day in an interaction, but what we're trying to do is to get people started on that journey. And it is easier than people think. When I say that, I don't just mean our students and people that we interact with here in El Salvador. I mean Bitcoiners too. Like when I go to, I was in the conference in Miami in, what was that, in May? And I used Bitcoin less there at a Bitcoin conference than I do in just an average day here in El Salvador. And there were, you know, we had donations. We were accepting donations. We were selling t-shirts, and many people, like maybe 60% of the people, didn't pay with Bitcoin. They paid with cash instead. And then there were a few people who, you know, are Bitcoiners, right? They're going to this Bitcoin conference, that had only made one or two transactions with Bitcoin before, right? And like we almost had to, it was almost like they were a student that were new to it, right? So I think using Bitcoin is easier than a lot of people think, both within and without the space.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the metaphor of driving a car. Sure, if you've lived all your life on an island with horse-drawn carriages, donkeys for transportation, obviously a car is intimidating, seems very scary. But billions of people around the world know how to drive cars. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a process. You do it. And, you know, you start off with the guidance. Somebody's over your head. They teach you how to do it. You do it in a, you know, some, most people start sometimes in empty roads or parking lots where you're practicing with, in a setting where if things go wrong, nothing bad's going to happen. So if you lose control of the car in an empty parking lot, you know, you drive for a few meters or a few dozen meters in one direction and nothing bad happens to you. And then over time, you practice more and more, you get better at it. And then once you've established command of it, then you take the car and you go on the road. And I think that's, I think, a very good model for thinking about how to do Bitcoin. Yeah, of course, you can get all of your coins lost. You can mess it up. It's just like you could drive your car off a cliff, or you could drive into another car, or you can drive into a tree, and you can hurt yourself. But if you know what you're doing, you know, you go along, and it offers you enormous amounts of benefits. So you minimize the risks and you appreciate the benefits over time. And then you reach a point of command. You know, if you look at your average taxi driver, or not even your average, say, daily driver, people who drive every day to work, driving becomes second nature to them. They can drive while talking to somebody else. They can drive while thinking about something else. They can carry out a conversation and be fully focused on the topic of the conversation while also managing to navigate the road perfectly safely. So a lot of taxi drivers all over the world will have a microphone in their ears, and they'll be on the phone for hours with other people while they're driving, and it becomes second nature. After a while, once you know what you're doing, and when you figure out what you're doing, you become pretty good at it. And there's no reason why Bitcoin custody and using Bitcoin should be any different. Yeah, it's a technical thing, but there's a way of doing it. And there are different ways of doing it. And this is, I think, the key thing. It's on a sense, in some sense, it's kind of intimidating that there are different ways of doing it. You could have a hardware wallet. You could have a phone wallet. You could have a wallet on your laptop. You could have a paper wallet if you want, or, you know, you could have multi-sig, and there are many different options. And so that can be confusing and intimidating, but in reality, it shouldn't be, because all of these options offer you different trade-offs that optimize for your own situation, your own skills, your own security. How are you able to keep things safe? What kind of devices you have access to? So, yeah, I'm not too astonished to say that.
I think that's a great analogy with the car thing. And it's a process, right? It's really, really hard to be a professional driver that, you know, you're an F1 or whatever. It's not that hard to go to an empty parking lot and start, right? So it's a process, and we all start in empty parking lots. And that is not hard. And that's something that we have to remind people that you don't have to start as an F1 driver, right? You just start in an empty parking lot.
Exactly. Yeah. So when it comes to the material that you teach, what kind of feedback have you gotten from the students about your material and about the Bitcoin process? I'm curious, this kind of mass production of Bitcoiners. So far you said you've had something like 20,000 students who have covered this material, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is enormously valuable in terms of the feedback that they give. What are the things that they found to be most useful to understand about Bitcoin? What are the things that they found the most difficult, most useless?
Yeah. And this varies, you know, student to student a little bit. But something that I've been really impressed with is, so the very first page of the diploma asks why Bitcoin? And the very last page asks why Bitcoin? The answers that the students give is really insightful, because in the beginning, it's mostly blank. It's like, I don't know why Bitcoin. But by the end, you know, people write like mini essays about it, especially the students that, like the really good students who really get it. And what resonates with me most is the ones that see it as a way to have better control over their future. Like it clicks with many people. So El Salvador is a place that doesn't have its own currency. So it's dollarized here. They dollarized in 2001, I believe. I think there are concepts that we know intuitively, but then when it's explained to us, then we understand it in a new way. And I think like a concept that people understand intuitively is that they don't control their money. And when you don't control your money, you don't control your life. And that's especially true in a place that like their own government doesn't. I mean, even in a place like the US, you don't control your money. But in a place like El Salvador, it's even more exaggerated, because their own government isn't even the one that prints the money and makes those monetary policies and decisions. You know, there's inflation with the dollar, and which is like a current topic, right? Things are getting more expensive. And people know that it's not because of something that they did, right? It's because of policies that were decided somewhere else without their input. And that comes across with many students or the ones that like really stand out to me. They could really conceptualize that a lot better after learning about Bitcoin. And what we do, again, we try to make the material as interactive as possible. That's something that we're forever moving in that direction. So just an example, an activity that we do to explain mining, or to explain, this is maybe an easier one, to explain the double coincidence of wants, right? So this is like pre-Bitcoin. Then like everybody has slips of paper with different items, and they know they have another item that they want to get, but how are you going to get it? And, you know, they have to like talk to all these different people, and maybe they don't get it because they've traded it to someone else by that time and they want to hold on to it. And it's just a very inefficient method of exchanging, you know, what you have for what you want. So like people don't even understand money. They intuitively understand why having a common denominator is important. But after they do activities like that, then they understand it in a new way. And again, what we continually find is people learn these concepts best when they could practice them themselves. And, you know, everybody learns differently, right? Some people learn through lectures, some people learn through reading. But we have found for Bitcoin specifically, the interactive education works really well, because that's a mental block that people have. with Bitcoin because it is not tangible. So to make it as to make it physical to when you explain it, we have found has been really, really useful.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about Bitcoin adoption in El Salvador in general, in terms of the way that it is taken off? So one of the criticisms that you usually hear is that Bitcoin is a bottom-up thing, but this is being imposed top-down in El Salvador, and that's against the ethos of Bitcoin. Generally, anytime somebody says the ethos of Bitcoin, I reach for my wallet and I think they're about to try and rip me off, or at least they're trying to concern troll about something ridiculous, because they're just projecting things on Bitcoin. Bitcoin is software, and it's you know, it's a journalist thing to try and always impose a narrative on things, because then you impose a narrative and then you get to complain that people are not abiding by the narratives and that you are. So sorry for taking half of the answer away from you, but yeah.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
No, I think we see eye to eye on that. So, you know, you talked about that people are imposing things on Bitcoin, and I totally agree. Bitcoin doesn't care. Bitcoin doesn't care whether the president of a country encouraged his citizens to use it, or whether the citizens encouraged its president to use it, right? Like, Bitcoin doesn't care if it's top down, bottom up. I think there's a variety of different ways that Bitcoin adoption will come, and I support all of them. I think there's going to be a mix of different things. There is, you know, the again, going back to Bitcoin Beach, I think that was a project that encourage the government in El Salvador to take that step, right? And Bitcoin Beach is this bottom-up thing. I mean, Bitcoin is a bottom-up thing, right? So it's like they both exist at the same place and the same time. And there's a lot of advantages from just where I sit. I think it's important that education is independent and impartial. And this is not a government program, right? We are not a government organization. We have no funding from the government, no direction from the government, but we work with them, because we have shared objectives for some things. And that makes it so much easier for us. Like, it would be so much harder if this was a hostile environment. So yeah, our approach is bottom up, but like, there's such a benefit at the same time to have a friendly government. So yeah, going back to one of the things that attracts me to Bitcoin is that it doesn't care, right? Bitcoin doesn't care where you were born. It doesn't care who you voted for. It doesn't care how much or how little Bitcoin you have, right? And I think we should take a cue from Bitcoin and not care.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is very rich, because it's usually coming from the kind of people that are essentially fiat coin enthusiasts. And, you know, the alternative to Bitcoin is the dollar, Bitcoin is the only alternative to the dollar. And so it's pretty rich coming from people who are essentially telling you that, no, you should join the global monetary system that has one central bank controlled by a few criminals in the US government, and then have that monetary system be used everywhere in the world, and that anybody who's trying to get out of that is wrong because it's not purely bottoms up enough. And of course, I think the best way of thinking about it is that El Salvador government itself is a bottom-up approach to try and get out of the World Bank, IMF, U.S. Federal Reserve, global slavery system. And that's really what it is about. I think ultimately the most important thing for me about the adoption of Bitcoin, and this is something that's not very popular for Bitcoiners. Most Bitcoiners don't like me to say this, but for me, the most important thing in El Salvador is the fact that the government is stacking sats rather than U.S. Treasury bonds. This is really what it comes down to. If the government is able to get out of holding U.S. Treasuries by holding more and more Bitcoin, and if the government is able to get out of debt because they can hold an asset that appreciates rather than continue to hold bonds that depreciate over time and continuously need to continue to borrow, that's going to be the real issue. That's going to be the real thing. If the best thing that any government could do for its people is break out of the fiat slavery system, break out of the dollar's hegemony, break out of the system wherein they need to keep holding dollars, and they need to keep dealing with the Federal Reserve, they need to keep borrowing from the IMF, borrowing from the global dollar capital markets, because that's a treadmill. It's a system for slavery. So you're constantly holding dollars and dollar-denominated assets that are depreciating with time because the U.S. government can print more of them. And so you're running on a treadmill, effectively. You can't get ahead in that kind of system. You're always, and it's not even a treadmill, it's going backwards because, you know, every year your assets are depreciating. And so therefore, your country is effectively being enslaved. So you need to be working hard in order to be buying more assets and paying off, getting into debt. That's your only way of trying to beat this, is to get into debt. You can't finance your expenditures from your savings, from your cash balance, because your cash balance is constantly depreciating. So you need to constantly be borrowing. And that's how they get you, basically. So for me, even if nobody in El Salvador was using Bitcoin at all, and the government was just stacking sats with the long-term view of holding more of this so that they don't have to continuously go to the capital markets to borrow in dollars and witness their dollar-denominated assets depreciate, that, I think, is grassroots enough for me. And if you don't like that because, you know, it's coming from the president and it's not being driven, you know, we didn't first have every single person in El Salvador holding their own private keys and running their own node and doing all of the rituals and the processes of Bitcoin individually before the government adopts it, then I'm going to go ahead and guess that you're just interested in propagating the dollar's cartel monopoly. And I'm going to go ahead and also make a guess that you are getting paid by an organization that gets printed dollars from the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve, which, you know, is true for pretty much all academics. And most U.S.-based institutions.
I think one of the great things about Bitcoin, again, and this is like similar to the previous point, is that different people will come at it from different angles, right? Like, what attracts me to Bitcoin is different from what attracts the next person to Bitcoin. Like, the advantage that I see from integrating Bitcoin into my life is different from the advantage that the government of El Salvador sees with integrating it. But that doesn't mean that only one should be happening, right? That it should only be happening based on like what makes sense from my specific perspective. Like I like the phrase, Bitcoin is your enemy's money, right? Like it's not, people will use it in ways that you wouldn't. And that's okay, right? You don't have to. You don't have to agree with who uses Bitcoin. Anybody could, you know, whether it's a government, an individual. I'm happy to, you know, I'm obviously happy to see what El Salvador is doing with Bitcoin. That's why I'm here. I think El Salvador has so much potential to create positive precedents and examples that that others can follow, right? Like they're creating a template here, and they're creating a template on a variety of different levels. They're creating a template on at a government level, but I hope that we are creating a template at a grassroots education level. There's other projects that are creating their own templates because this is an environment that is friendly to experimenting with different ways to achieve Bitcoin adoption. And that is such a valuable thing that we have an environment that allows for that to happen. I'm really excited about the future of Bitcoin and the future of El Salvador. I think we probably share that view, right? With your recent trip here, this is a really hopeful place. And it's not just Bitcoin, right? It's hopeful for a variety of other things. But I think Bitcoin fits really well into that. Like, I think Bitcoin for me represents the future and more control over our future. And the more we have control over our future, the more we're encouraged to do something positive with that control, right? And that's true with Bitcoin, but it's also true here in El Salvador, specifically with safety issues, that, you know, people feel like they have more control in their life now for a variety of different things. It's not just Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin just matches really well with that. But it's such a hopeful place here, a place that strives towards the future rather than cowers from it. And that makes everything, right? That changes everything.
Yeah. I really think this is very true. I think, and it's something that I tweeted when I first came back from El Salvador, which is you go anywhere in the world and everybody's basically complaining about how everything's getting more expensive and how the future is looking darker and less promising. And, you know, the housing is so much more expensive. I'm never going to be able to afford a house or this problem or that problem. Everybody's always got bad things going on when they're looking at their future pretty much everywhere in the world. And I think ultimately it's inflation that's at the heart of that. Obviously, you know, if you listen to mainstream media, they tell you it's because of carbon dioxide ruining the weather, or it's because of diseases or viruses or whatever. That's what's ruining everything. And of course, that's ridiculous. Carbon dioxide is not ruining the weather, and people aren't worried about the world being imperceptibly warmer by a tiny little bit in the next few years. What's ruining people's lives and what's making them very, very worried is almost always inflation. And in El Salvador, I mean, we're not at a point where people in El Salvador are able to, you know, think of themselves as having escaped inflation by no stretch of the imagination. We're still very early. The vast majority of people in El Salvador don't have any serious amount of Bitcoin in their savings. And the government, you know, they're probably about even on their Bitcoin position. So Bitcoin hasn't even been very profitable for them. So it's not fair to say that it is Bitcoin that has changed the economic fortunes of the country. It's not Bitcoin that is fixing El Salvador, but it is a Bitcoiner who is fixing El Salvador. I think that's the really key point. It is the president is a Bitcoiner at the end of the day, and he does understand this. And he does have a vision of the future. And I think this is something that I can always keep insisting upon in my work, which is that once you have a harder money, once you're able to escape inflation, then you're able to see further ahead. The future becomes less uncertain for you. And then you're able to plan more and more for the future. And for me, this is part of the kind of mentality that would drive him toward wanting to, you know, fight the gangs, do something that might be in the short term quite expensive, you know, politically risky, because, you know, the war didn't have to work out as well as it did. It could have been expensive politically. It could have been risky and dangerous militarily. You know, the military and the police might have suffered serious losses from fighting with the gangs. And it could have been really expensive, of course, with the foreign gangs that support the local gangs, which is essentially the international NGO criminal cartel and the fiat banking system, which seems to be extremely fond of criminal gangs everywhere in the world. And I think you see this not just in El Salvador and in Latin America in general, you also see it in the US. There clearly does seem to be a very serious meeting of the minds, let's say, between your local street thugs and the international fiat system and the beneficiaries of the fiat system. So you look at a place like the US, I mean, you can get arrested for defending yourself from somebody who has tried to attack you. And it's much harder to get arrested if you just initiate attacks. And I think the last couple of weeks, we've seen several pretty high profile examples of this. And, you know, if you've been to any major US city recently, which I don't recommend for anybody, you'll see just how absolutely amazingly unsafe the streets are, how many clearly criminal people are out in the streets and doing bad things and getting away with them. And I think it's pretty telling. You know, we see all of this, what are called the George Soros DAs, who are just getting into power in the district attorney position and not prosecuting people who commit crimes. It's quite startling that, you know, you see these human rights organizations, they're not speaking out about, you know, why is it that it's okay for criminals to go around terrorizing people in San Francisco and New York and LA? Why don't those, you know, the rights of the people, the rights of law-abiding people in major American cities, somehow not an issue, just like the rights of people in El Salvador? But when those criminals do get thrown in jail, that's when they become extremely concerned about, you know, what if the trial wasn't entirely fair? And I think, you know, if you were to think it in terms of numbers, there are almost certainly many, 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 many more unjustly imprisoned people in the U.S. than there are in El Salvador, both in terms of overall numbers and most likely even in terms of percentages as well, because in the U.S. criminal system is notorious for arresting people who defend themselves, prosecuting them when they try and defend themselves, and also, you know, prosecuting people for all kinds of victimless crimes, which are pretty common over there. But we don't see that sort of thing happening. And we don't see this thing concern the human rights NGOs. We don't see this kind of thing matter. It's only somehow when you're actually successfully fighting crime that they become really concerned about human rights records and about potentially somebody in jail might not have received a fully fair trial. It's pretty startling. And I think it's been, for me, I think it's been the biggest slap in the face of the credibility of a lot of these international human rights organizations and a lot of these, the international community, is that suddenly they become extremely concerned about El Salvador once El Salvador manages to fight crime effectively. I think it's very, very telling, and it does not look good.
Yeah. I mean, El Salvador, and like, you know, I'm not saying that I agree with 100% of what the government here does. I don't agree with 100% of any government, right? But the story of safety here, people feel safer, and that's demonstrable, right? That is a good thing. That is a good thing, and that's what people want, right? This is not being imposed upon people. This is what people are asking for. And I think that's an important distinction that is often missed. This isn't being imposed. This is something that time and time again, you know, 90% plus of the population is very much supportive of all this stuff. And it's really hard to get 90% of any population to agree on anything. So to have like approval ratings of different policies so high, I think is something worth including, something worth, you know, just being conscious of. This isn't something that's being imposed upon an unwilling population. It's quite the opposite. And then, you know, like we briefly talked in El Salvador about this But time preference is such an important thing. And like, you know, Bitcoin teaches us to change our time preference. But I think that, again, I think that's naturally happening here. And I'm very optimistic that Bitcoin is going to dovetail very well into that. People are already, without Bitcoin, Bitcoin, I think, is generally our best tool to help show people the value of having a low time preference, right? Like it encourages us to think into the future. But that's happening all on its own here, right? So to combine that with Bitcoin is just, I don't know, I am excited to see what comes of this grand experiment.
Yeah, and I think I agree. And I think, you know, I consider myself an anarchist. I'd rather live in a world in which governments don't exist. But you know, it's not the dunk that you think it is when you tell me, oh well, you're supporting a government that is going to be holding Bitcoin, or the government that is initiating a crackdown. Yeah, ideally, I wouldn't want to have a government, and because I believe that in a free world, anything that a government can do, I think private actors can do much better if they did not have a monopoly. However, in the presence of a monopoly, this does not mean that a monopoly cannot do things badly versus do things well. So I'm not going to stay stuck at home for all the rest of my life and never leave because all the roads around me have been built by government. Yes, it was a government that built the road. Yes, ideally, and I think that you know, a world in which private property owners built their own roads would be much more efficient. We've had a discussion with Walter Block about roads in one of the podcast episodes before. But that does not mean that, you know, I'm not going to ever use a government road. And it doesn't make me a hypocrite if I get on a government road. And it doesn't make me a hypocrite if I say that, you know, they messed up this particular road. And it doesn't make me a hypocrite if I say, oh, wow, they built an actually good road here that works really well. It's possible for them to do things badly and well. And so, yeah, I think ideally I'd rather not have governments at all. But they do exist at this point. And in this kind of situation, you know, when they do have a monopoly on violence, or when they do have a monopoly on security, on fighting crime, there are ways of doing this well and there are ways of doing this badly. And I think El Salvador shows that even with a monopoly, you can do a lot better of a job than most people think. I mean, for me, what's astonishing is just how much crime has been normalized. For most people, they've accepted the idea that living in a big city just means that you're going to have this, what they call, you know, a vibrant city. Then it just means that people are going to be, you know, assaulting each other all day, every day. There's going to be robberies and there's going to be theft and there's going to be the occasional murder. And that's just the price you have to pay for being in a big city. But it isn't. Humanity has had big cities that weren't crime-ridden cesspools. We continue to have them. You go to Dubai today, it's a safe place. You walk around, there is no crime, there are no problems, and there isn't. And interestingly enough, also, you rarely see, you know, a heavy-handed police presence. People are just free and safe to walk around and do what they want. It's not like the police are harassing you all day in order to make sure that crime isn't a problem. In fact, you are more likely to be bothered by the police in places where crime is a problem, because when crime is a problem, that means the police is being incompetent. And one great way for the police to be incompetent is to go after law-abiding people, because law-abiding people are not dangerous. So, you know, go after teenage boys smoking weed is a lot better than going after criminals, because, you know, an arrest is an arrest, but the teenage boys smoking weed are less likely to shoot back at you. They're less likely to pull out a gun. So I still think, you know, that there is a good way of doing this. And I think it's pretty startling how El Salvador has managed to pull this off in a way that makes me, you know, as an anarchist, you know, really have to admit that, yeah, it is possible even for a monopoly to do this in a way that is not completely destructive.
Yeah. And I would also self-identify as an anarchist. And it is so, like, if I could go back in time to 3 years ago and tell myself, like, in 3 years, you'll be having meetings with, like, the Minister of Education of a country and with working with the government in this way and that way, I wouldn't have believed it, right? But it's like, this is the reality that we have. This is an amazing opportunity to get a toehold for Bitcoin, to experiment with Bitcoin. And that is more important than any preconceived notions about purity tests, whether, you know, this is, you know, well, government built a road, so I can't go on it if that means you support the government. This is a really fascinating time. And I think there are a lot of people here in El Salvador who are attracted to this country who also have, like, very hostile views towards government generally. And like, I think it's really important that people can, if they see it for themselves, right? Like, come to El Salvador and see what's happening here with your own eyes. Like, don't believe what you read. Don't believe what you hear on Twitter. Don't believe me. You know, don't trust Verify. And there are so many people that I've met that have done that, that, you know, they've changed their mind. They obviously had curiosity about the place for them to come in the first place. But it is, so just within Meet Premier Bitcoin, there's a number of, I think, all the foreigners that work for it, right? So it's an international project. So it's a mix of Salvadorians, and there's also foreigners such as myself. And I think all of the foreigners that work on the project came to visit El Salvador, saw there was something worth fighting for here, and never left. And there's a certain, like, magic to that, like a certain beauty to that. And these are, again, these are people that probably would have never expected them to be working on a project that cooperates with the government on some issues. But, you know, we don't live in theory, we live in reality, right? And this is, the reality is that El Salvador is a very important place in the world right now. Like, what happens here today will have an effect on what happens in the world tomorrow. And there are so few times in human history where an individual or, like, a group of people could have such a big impact, right? Like, I think this is such a high leverage moment for anyone who cares about the future. Like, it's being built right here, right now. And, you know, don't complain about it, change it, right? Like, you could come here and you could, this is a very malleable space right now. If there's something you don't like, then figure out what you think is better and work towards that, right? That's how I see it, at least.
Yeah, I think I agree. And what is your impression of what El Salvadorans think? So are all of these opinion polls actually real, or do you think they're fabricated? Is it real that 92% of Salvadorans approve of the job that the president is doing?
So this is something that I think I would be quite skeptical of if I wasn't living here, because politicians are unpopular generally around the world, but specifically in Latin America. Like, politicians are unpopular here, which is, again, going back to the start of the podcast, something that attracts me about Latin America is that people, like, stand up against their governments here. No, but it's real. Like, it's nuanced, right? There's within that number, there's some people who are, like, ride or die with this government. And then there are other people who are more pragmatic, like, hey, I don't like everything that they're doing, but overall, this is a big change in the right direction. Like, I don't like everything, but it's a net positive, right? Not everyone's like, I love everything. There's probably a majority within that would be able to pick out things that they don't like with this government, but they see it as a net positive. El Salvador has come from not a very hopeful past, right? They had an actual civil war which ended in 1992, and then the two sides from the Civil War became the two dominant political parties who kind of continued the war by other means. You know, they just, I mean, it's makes me think of the U.S. a little bit, that there's so much, like, you know, one side just hates the other, and that's such a bad energy. But it was not a hopeful place, right? So there's been a really dramatic change in a short amount of time, and people feel it in their everyday life here. Like, they're not afraid to go out at night. You know, their perception of themselves has changed. And so, yeah, that's real. And I say this as someone who has a Salvadoran girlfriend who is in that 8% that doesn't support the government. Like, I get a fair amount of exposure to it, like, through that. And even within that social group of that 8%, it's nuanced, right? It's like, well, yeah, but this is still good. You know, like, I don't like this thing that's happening, and that's an important thing for me, so I'm gonna be in this 8%. But there's also, I'll reluctantly admit that there's good things happening too. So yeah, short answer to the question, that approval rate, in hard as it is to believe, is real.
And what do you think are the major quibbles and disgruntlement that this 8% has? What are the biggest problems that they have?
That's a good question, because the biggest problem that internationally people have with the government of El Salvador is, you know, like a due process sort of issue. Like, you're arresting people without going through, you know, checking off all the boxes that you should. That's not really a concern that people have here. I think there's always going to be an opposition, right? So, like, within that 8%, some people are just in the former dominant political parties that have roles in those political parties. So they have really strong incentives to not support what's happening, because they're being displaced, which is not a real concern, right? That's like a really self-serving concern. I think there are, even though this isn't, I don't think this is the majority within that 8%, but there are people that do have more Western style critiques about a consolidation of power that they feel uncomfortable with, and, you know, worried that if Bukele is the exception of the rule, the next person won't be, you know, the exception that, like, power doesn't corrupt, that the next person won't be, and there's, like, an infrastructure set up. And that's, like, these are real things, right? And, like, I sympathize with that for sure. I don't sympathize with the people that, you know, had cushy jobs in the old system and just don't like the changes because of that. You know, even within that group, no one thinks that El Salvador was safer 2 years ago than it is today, right? Like, and that's a big deal. That's a big deal that it is safer, that there is that hope. So there are valid concerns that people have, but yeah, again, it's like hard to believe, but the number is real. It really is so widely supported what's happening here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, wait until Bitcoin number goes up, does its thing, I think. There's a limit of 100% approval rate, but there's no limit on how far Bitcoin can keep going. So if they're this happy with Bitcoin still at, what is it today, 26 or whatever, you know, if Bitcoin does what it's been doing for the past 14 years, I think they might be a lot happier soon.
Right. And this gives me hope too. Like, I see a lot of things through the vantage point of me from Rare Bitcoin, right? Because that's like, that is my life. That is my obsession. Like, everything that I do is working towards making that a success. But it's not just that. It's so many other things, right? This is just my prism, how I view things. But it is so inspiring and hopeful for me to see a Bitcoin education project grow in a bear market. And it is so inspiring and hopeful for me to see all these other projects and all these other initiatives happening here in El Salvador with the goal of Bitcoin adoption growing in these conditions, right? Like, I think El Salvador is really bucking the trend, and it makes me optimistic to the point of fear of what's going to happen when things turn, because like one of the things that we're working on now, so we're going through like we're kind of always going through a restructuring, right? Because we're an NGO, but we operate with a kind of a mentality of a startup, like move fast and break things. So because of that, we're always having to redesign systems as we grow and as we have to punch through new barriers and obstacles. But this is a bigger than usual one that we're going through now, and it's mostly trying to create an infrastructure and setting ourselves up for the future, because as much demand as there is today, we're trying to anticipate a future in which the demand just explodes, right? And it's like, how are we going to handle that? How, because, you know, one of the downsides of a bull market is it brings out, you know, shitcoiners and profit seeking, and it makes people vulnerable to scams and to negative things. And it's like, okay, how are we going to create a system to try to mitigate that, like through education? That's the lens that I look at it from. But I know that like the government is also trying to create that infrastructure, like other projects are trying to create that infrastructure here. It is going to be wild, and I think wildly positive, but you know, the fear that I mentioned is are we ready? And the answer is no. Like, we're never ready for stuff like that, right? We're not ready for the world to change. We never are. We could try to anticipate it as much as we can. We could try to plan for it as much as we can, create that infrastructure as much as we can. But things are going to move very quickly here when that does turn. And, you know, again, I'm always trying to pitch people to come here. They come here now, see what things are like now, and come back in a year or two and see the difference. And because it's going to be something that I think will be unprecedented, right? Like I don't know what to compare it to.
Yeah, I think this is a good point. I hadn't thought about it, but I think it's a good point that if this, if the last couple of years were the 2 years before it, you know, when we had 2 years of just massive mania and the Bitcoin price going up and people speculating that this is it, this is, you know, remember the super cycle talk and that price is never going to go down. If we'd had that, if El Salvador had lucked out and started, you know, 2 years earlier, so they, you know, they started off at Bitcoin at around, say, 3,000-4,000, and then it went up all the way to the 60s and 70s. You can imagine your job would be a lot more difficult in a sense, because A, there'd be a lot more demand, but there'd also be a lot more confusion, a lot more hype, and a lot more shit coins, a lot more yield scams, and people coming up and telling you, oh no, you know, you don't want to just hold your Bitcoin, you want to make your Bitcoin work for you by giving it to me, and where I could give you a yield risk-free, but just don't ask me for where I get it, because in reality, you are the yield, as we've discussed before. And so in a sense, you've gotten the you got lucky with that sense, but I'm curious, how is it with other shitcoins and with other kind of projects, or with the scams, or with people trying to sell Ponzi's based on Bitcoin and stuff like that? Do you have a problem with that? Do you notice it as being a major distraction that you see with your students, that they come in and you like teach them a little bit about Bitcoin, and then they tell you, well, my cousin told me about this better, faster thing called Ripple or Bitcoin Act or Ethereum or whatever?
So we did in the beginning, in like, you know, those first months, so this tail end of 2021, which, you know, is still a bull market, then people did come in, they'd be like, yeah, Bitcoin. But I heard about this Luna thing, or I heard about like whatever, and there was more of it was a more confusing environment, right? That has gone away, and I think that has mostly gone away, not like 100%, but that has mostly gone away. I think it's twofold. One is that I think El Salvador has made the right move to not put out the welcome mat for you know, other coins and more nefarious projects. But I think actually the bear market has actually done most of the heavy lifting there, that people aren't, they're not hearing about it, they're not passing that on. So yeah, that is something that I worry will come back. And it's like, it's the sort of, it's the opposite of, I don't know what the phrase is, but the opposite of silver lining, right? It's like this positive thing, but like there's a negative thing that comes with it. And I think it's, you know, going to be a wholly positive thing to get so much more attention on Bitcoin, so much more curiosity that people want to learn about it and use it. But the negative of that is, as people are here, like, oh, my neighbor, whatever, made money doing X, like, I want to make money doing X too, or I want to find the next X. People aren't looking for the next Bitcoin right now. When, as soon as there's some stupid meme coin that goes up 1,000%, then they're going to look for the next one, right? So it's a double-edged sword. It's mostly positive, but I think that is something that, and El Salvador will be a really interesting place because this is the first country that has adopted Bitcoin. So how are they going to handle it? And I think that's why education is so important. It's so important to have this foundation. So we've taught over 20,000 students so far. So by the time it turns, I don't know what the numbers will be. I mean, these are relatively small numbers for a country, you know, with millions. But if we could create, I mean, so like how I conceptualize it in my mind is because we work in the whole country, right? Like there's 14 departments, we're active in all 14 of them. Within all the students that we teach, there's going to be a certain percent that you know, they kind of just move on. But a certain percent will get really deep into it and become advocates of it. And they will be ambassadors of it. So if we could just have a number of people like distributed around the country, Salvadorians who are seen as people who are knowledgeable about the space, when things explode, they're going to be really important because they're going to be people that will be able to guide their communities, their workplaces, their families, and kind of naturally advise people like, oh yeah, no, I've looked into it. I went down the rabbit hole last year or 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever. And they're going to be ambassadors for it. So it's important for us now to make sure that we create that foundation. And I think the stronger that foundation is, the more likely all that bullshit gets a lid put on it very quickly. So that's what we're thinking about. And I think other great projects are thinking about this. I think the Bitcoin office is thinking about this, how to anticipate that and how to look forward and plan for it. I'm optimistic, but you know, it is going to be an interesting time. And I mean that in all senses, like when things turn, things are going to get very interesting here.
I certainly hope so. And I should have mentioned this earlier, but all of your material is available open source, right?
Yes. In fact, so all of our material is open source. We have a GitHub, also just on our webpage. You could download it. We do it ourselves in English and Spanish, but we are working with people from the community who are translating it into a variety of different languages, French, German, Portuguese, Swahili. I don't even know what all of them are, but yeah, the long-term goal is to open source everything. So it's not just the educational materials, but it's our accounting, it's our decision-making processes, all that. So like for accounting is a good example, it's kind of a mess because we only work in Bitcoin. So we pay a teacher a salary and they have their salary is fixed to a dollar number. So the number of sats that they get each month is different, which makes things a little bit more complicated. So we're trying to work through and we're trying to find best practices for everything that we do so we could share that. So it's not just, so right now all the education materials are open source and they're being used around the world. Like they're being used. We work with projects. So, you know, projects like Amity Age in Honduras or Bitcoin Jungle in Costa Rica or Bitcoin Lake in Guatemala. So we actively work with some projects to try to help them, you know, try to give them advice, like what's worked for us to teach this. And then there are other people that just do it on their own. And like maybe they tag us in a tweet and it's like, oh, we just did week 8. And it's like, oh, I had no idea that that this group in London was even was doing this. So cool. So we don't know the whole number of people who are using it, but yeah, it's so encouraging to see, and the world is changing so fast. And I think this is, you know, Bitcoin is a big part of it, but like that to open source is a value that we hold in such high regard because it's proof of work, right? It's like to build walls around the product that you develop to me indicates a lack of faith in it, right? That it can't survive on its own. It could only survive if it's like in this more like proof of stake sort of system. So this is a change, right? I think the world is moving toward a Bitcoin standard. It's moving towards a standard, towards a proof of work standard as well.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think that's definitely, it pisses off a lot of no coiners for us to suggest that switching the operating system of society is going to have any kind of implications because it makes them have to think uncomfortable thoughts about the world in which they live in. It's like telling a fish that, you know, the water that you've always been in is actually polluted, and that's why you're so messed up. It's the water that you're swimming in. And you know, they don't want to change their water. They're happy in the sewage that they're in.
People are afraid of change, right? It's like, people are afraid of change, but they shouldn't be. We should embrace change. And I think one of the reasons why people are afraid of change is because the world that we live in avoids pain, right? Like, we're always trying to avoid pain in the world that we live in. Like, if you lose your password, just reset it. Somebody else will help you reset it. If you lose your phone, you didn't back it up, then you lost your Bitcoin on it, right? And that's how it should be. You should feel pain. You should have responsibility. And if you don't administer that responsibility well, you should feel pain because you will learn from that pain. We live in a world in which we are increasingly insulated from that. And that makes us, it creates this negative feedback loop, which makes us ever more fearful of change. And the world is, the pace of change in the world is accelerating. So if you're afraid of change, then learn how to deal with it, or you're going to be very uncomfortable in the coming years.
Yeah. We've got Peter who's asking a question. Could you give us more details on how Bitcoin adoption has progressed in El Salvador since you first moved there? Do you have any metrics that can help us understand how much Bitcoin is being used by the general population?
Okay. Oh, cool. Yeah, I didn't even see this chat. There are surveys of like how many people have used Bitcoin in the past 90 days or the past 12 months or ever. And that number is going up. I think the numbers that I've seen, there's a couple of different surveys, but the numbers that I've seen are always between 5% and 20%, which is kind of a big range. The reality is probably somewhere in the middle. So we could say maybe 10%. Depends how you measure it, whether you measure it, it's someone that's used Bitcoin in the past. When you change that time period, then the number will change. But again, as I said, that number was very close to zero in 2021. So I think there is a critique that people have. Let's say just for a round number, 10%. Oh, so 90% aren't actively using Bitcoin. So it's a failure. And it's like, no, we went from zero to 10, from 0% to 10%, mostly in a bear market, which is, to me, incredible growth and a very clear trend. So there are other metrics like from that I think maybe the best source of them would be Bitcoin companies here. So payment processors, how many people have downloaded, you know, whatever the specific wallet is and how that has trended over time. And that's all trending. Again, all of these are small in that it's a minority, right? It's not like 60% of the country is using this. But for me, what I look at and what I think is more important is the trend. And the trend is again very clear that every day, every week, every month, more people are exposed to this. More businesses are using it. So that's the metric that matters.
Yeah, No, I think that's ultimately what it is. There's, I think a lot of people in fiat just expect this to be a quick thing. And I always tell people this isn't an app that people are downloading. It's not WhatsApp. It's not Facebook. It's not something that can take off very quickly, because it's, you know, Bitcoin may be software, but the function that it fulfills is money, and it takes the place of other monies in your cash balance. And moving away from one money to another is not a simple task. It's a very complicated thing, because your cash balance being in one currency means that all of your assets and all of the money that you make, all of the money that you spend, all of the suppliers that you buy from, all of the people that you pay, they're all used to using a particular currency with you. And you can't just wake up one day and tell them, hey, I'm not paying you in dollars anymore, I'm paying you in Bitcoin. And so there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem in there, but it's not really a chicken and egg problem. It just takes time. You know, so people think of it as a chicken and egg, like, yeah, no, you have to switch completely and then they'll switch. But that's not how it works. What happens is that gradually you grow your Bitcoin cash balance and gradually they grow their Bitcoin cash balance. And over time, if Bitcoin continues to work and it continues to appreciate while fiat money continues to depreciate, then naturally the cash balances in Bitcoin are going to grow a lot more, and that's going to make it a lot better.
Right. And that's something that I've noticed that happens naturally is like stores that accept Bitcoin. And maybe to go back to Peter's question, Bitcoin is easy to use here. Like I mostly use Bitcoin because if I'm going to get coffee and there's two coffee shops and one has a good payment processor that uses Bitcoin, I'm going to go there rather than the one next to it. But, you know, that's not something that the average Salvadorian does. The average Salvadorian is, you know, again, it's minority that uses it, but it's trending in the right direction. But a thing that I've seen naturally occur is people that have both, that have dollars in Bitcoin, like it's a business that accepts Bitcoin, so they have a balance there. They spend their dollars and they save their Bitcoin. And that is not something that they were told to do. It's something that just naturally has happened in many cases. It's encouraging for me. I think the best teacher we have is Bitcoin itself, like just the incentive system that it has. Like it incentivizes us to save, right? Like, so with this person that has dollars in Bitcoin, Bitcoin is the one to save and dollars are the one to spend because dollars are worth less in the future. Bitcoin is worth more in the future. So yeah, it's cool to see it in the real world. And again, this is why I know I keep like hammering on how great El Salvador is, but it's not theory. It's happening, right? It's not happening with everyone everywhere all the time, but if you look for it, you could see it happening in the real world.
Yeah.
Right here, right now.
Yeah. And that's a good way of putting it. All right. Tell us more about where people can find you, how they can help, what they can do, how they can take your resources and what they can do with them, how they can use them. What other general information you can give?
Yep. So a few things. You know, I'll start with the most obvious. So it's just to donate. So we give away Bitcoin. We pay our teachers in Bitcoin. Like, you know, we break down our expenses, what we use. You could donate on our website. We also have a campaign on Geyser where you could find us to donate there. And that's super helpful. But then there's so many other ways to help. So you could translate the Bitcoin diploma into your local language. You could teach it in your local community. You could reach out to us if you do want to do these things. And if you have questions, then we'll do our best to guide you along in that process to try to make it more successful. We're actually building a coalition of Bitcoin educators around the world who are interested in this particular brand of Bitcoin education, which is independent, impartial, community-led Bitcoin education. So we work together to share best practices. Some of the projects that I mentioned earlier, we're in constant communication with them to see how we could help each other and learn from each other's mistakes and successes and failures and advancements and all of that. And you could be part of that, right? Like that's the power of Bitcoin, is it empowers us to take control of our own lives. And And you could do this in your own community, in your own place, in your own country. Like, we'll do our best to share best practices with you and to share materials with you, but you can do it. And we'll do our best to help you do it. If you want to, you don't need to. You just download it from GitHub and do it on your own. Don't tell us. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you work with us or not. Like, we're happy that it happens. So do that. Reach out to us if you want help there. Find it. And the way to reach out to us, again, on our website, which is myfirstbitcoin.io or mefromredbitcoin.io. Find us on Twitter. So that's myfirstbitcoin_. And then expertise. So beyond money, what we forever need is expertise. We have really, really bold ambitions, which is to radically reimagine the world, right? And we believe that Bitcoin education will be the foundation for reimagining what's possible. So because we have such grand ambitions, so El Salvador is the focus, but the mission is the world. Because we have such grand ambitions, we need expertise in everything. So if you're great at something, you're a great curriculum developer, you're a great web designer, you're a great graphic designer, and you wanna help that way, then also reach out to us. And that's another good way. Come to El Salvador. So we're actually gonna have a charity auction dinner on July 19th. So that's hosted by Max and Stacy. They're gonna help us auction things off. It's at this great restaurant. It's the first Salvadorian restaurant to win an international food award. So they're hosting us, and we're hoping to create a physical representation of one of the pillars of our mission, which is to create a common ground for Bitcoin education that we could all come together and agree that this is a good thing. You come at Bitcoin from different angles for different reasons, but a rising tide raises all boats. And good Bitcoin education is that tide, right? So we hope to make this an annual thing. This is something that we're doing this year. One of the things that will be auctioned, we're going to auction a whole bunch of different things, and this will hopefully give us some runway and some breathing room to continue to accelerate our growth. We have one of these Bitcoin diplomas that Sabrim has done us the honor of writing a dedication to whoever wins that auction. We're gonna like trickle out more items as we get closer. There's gonna be some really cool stuff. And again, we want to create that physical space. We want to make this an annual event, and we want to have some more financial security and runway to continue to push the envelope and push this forward. So I know that's a very long answer, but there's a lot of different ways that people could help. And they could help us specifically. They could help their own community. There's just so many different things that people could do. This is the time when we could reimagine the future. I really think that we're at a crossroads here. And I know that every generation thinks that.
They didn't have Bitcoin.
Yeah.
They were stuck with fiat. So
they didn't have Bitcoin. Like, this is real. This is don't. If you think the world could be better, then make it so. And if you want to work with us to do that, then we are overjoyed to do so.
Yeah. I should also say, I mean, I think the fact that you've educated so many students is a huge testament for the quality of your material, the fact that it continues to get used. So I strongly recommend people check it out for their own educational needs. You know, if you want to orange pill your kids, your friends, your neighbors, your cousins, I think this is an excellent way to get started, because it's something that's been tried. You know, when you're buying a product, generally the best thing you want to go with is something that has a lot of reviews from satisfied customers. And this is what we have here. So a lot of people have done guides to Bitcoin. Yours is one that's been out and tested in the wild. So I highly recommend it. And, you know, it's available in Spanish. It's been translated to English. And you could translate it to other languages as well. So take it and make the most of it, and let us know if you end up using it for something interesting and fun.
Exactly. Yes. That's great.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time and appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to seeing you again in El Salvador.
I hope so too. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers.
Take care.